Welcome back to Toys on Tap. This week is huge as Theo Kane from Slimehouse TV comes on. We talk his story. We talk all the toys and all the love, production, sculpting, tariffs, all good things about Theo Kane of Slimehouse TV. If you want more Toys on Tap, you can like, follow, rate, review wherever you get podcasts. It pushes it out, allows us to be heard by more people, which gives us the opportunity to do more. If you want to support Toys on Tap, patreon.com/toysontap. You can jump on that and support us. We're figuring out all the good stuff. And if you want more, even of that, on socials, at Toys on Tap. Absolutely love it. We have a couple drops coming, a couple cool things that will be here, and booth 614 at DesignerCon. We will be there. So don't be square. Show up to DesignerCon. Come say hi. Now let's get back to this episode, Toys on Tap.
Okay, I've got the sound working now. I can't hear you still, by the way, but...
Nothing?
Oh, there we go.
There we go.
There we go, brother. Sorry for that mess up. Are you live now? Yeah. Is it, like, straight in? Have you done, like, an intro and then you'd bring me in and then I'm just, like, not knowing what's going on?
No, we do the intro together.
All right. Okay.
Yeah. Because we have so much to talk about. I got a couple hours ready for you. And it's crazy how late it is there.
Time means nothing to me. When... Listen, when you work for yourself, you live at home, you work from home, and you make toys and YouTube for a living, like, time means nothing.
Yeah.
It literally means nothing. Yeah, it means no. As long as my cats are fed on time, that's all that matters, so. Yeah, I'm chilling, dude.
Heck yeah. Well, we start out every episode the same way. You got to introduce yourself, tell us who you are, what you do.
Okay, hold tight there. On Tap, Toys on Tap podcast, I'm Theo Kane of Slimehouse TV. I'm basically somebody that's done many things in the time that I've been on this earth, from being a competitive battle rapper to a filmmaker to a big-time toy hunter and all that stuff. And everything that I've done has all accumulated to me now being a guy that makes toys on YouTube and tries to film them in a cinematic way, because I came from a background of film, working in movies. I made a feature film and stuff and worked on things and worked on films in special effects, and that's all stuff that, like, later led to me being able to sculpt and things. I was a professional illustrator for most of my life. I still do that, but only, like, privately and for very specific clients and things. And, obviously, when you're a battle rapper, you have to be able to perform in front of, like, hundreds, sometimes thousands of people and memorize a bunch of lines and things. So I got good at being able to memorize, like, long bits of script or whatever I wanted to talk about and bullet points and things and be able to relay them on camera while I'm making my videos. So, like, weirdly, everything that I've done in my life just all cumulatively come together to me now being somebody who runs Slimehouse TV full-time on YouTube. So I make toys on my YouTube channel. I spent years going out hunting for toys and reviewing them and stuff, and then, like, moved into the toy making space, which is a very small space on YouTube. But then, yeah, that's, I was going to say something else. I can't even remember what I was going to say, but that's primarily me and what I do. And I'm on this full time. I live it, I breathe it, including the resin fumes. And it's my favorite thing that I've ever done. And I've done lots of crappy jobs over the years, but this is my favorite.
That's wild. A battle rapper is... We're going to get to that. We've got to get to that.
Well, I don't even really talk about that anymore because it's, like, such a different thing to what I do now. And I mean, all the battles I did aren't even online and stuff anymore. But anybody that knows me from the battle rap world knows, like, what I was about at that time. It's basically just one of many things that helped me. Do you know, like, build up confidence on camera, talking, like, using my own accent and things like that and keeping it real. It's just something that I did for a few years, many years ago. But just one of the little things that helped make me the guy I am today and what I do today and the way that I present my videos and things.
Heck yeah. I'm pumped to get into your story because you have so much going on. You've lived and breathed toys from a very young age. You've got other stuff with movies and all that. So we're going to jump in all the way back to the beginning. You told me the beginning story of you with your dad and doing toy related stuff. And so before, like, tell me about childhood, the toys you had growing up, but then, like, walk me through that. You went to some insane stuff. You've seen some insane stuff. Tell me the story.
Seen some
about
shit,
that.
Man.
Let's do it.
Can we curse on this show?
Absolutely.
Okay, I used to swear a lot in my videos, but then like a few of my other friends, when I like got into the YouTube thing, were like, oh, maybe you should like dial back on the swearing and things. It might help your videos get pushed a bit more. And just like naturally, as you get older, you just swear a little bit less and things, because I used to curse like a sailor. And also, I grew up like watching like Angry Video Game Nerd, Kevin Smith, all on YouTube. So to me, swearing was nothing. But yeah, nowadays it's... maybe can help stop your videos getting pushed a little bit more to like a younger audience and things. So I try and reel it back. But in my day-to-day life, yeah, I'm a swearer. So if I do let the odd one slip, then it's...
As long as
I know I don't have to try and censor myself. But I mean, I was a college teacher and a school teacher and all sorts in my life. I've done all sorts. So I can rein it back when I need to. I worked many like office jobs where you got to be professional all day, wear a shirt and a tie and act like someone you're not all day. So I can turn off that lingo if I need to. But yeah, man, to answer your question, I grew up being basically raised by a very loving mum and dad. I couldn't ask for a better mum and dad. And my dad was always an antique dealer. He was always a toy dealer, big toy dealer, always the kind of person as well that's like, he taught me that like you never go past a skip. Do you know like a dumpster, like what someone has outside the house when they're moving out and they throw loads of stuff out? He's like, you never go past one without having a little look in it.
What up, toy nerds? This is Ray.
And Dave. Go check out our brand new YouTube channel, The Toy Rats.
We make toys.
We talk about toys.
We talk about old toys.
And new toys.
And toys that we make.
And we're just a bunch of goofballs. It's a good time.
We make fun of Dave a lot.
I'm all right with that. So yeah, if you get a chance, go check out Toy Rats on YouTube. You won't be disappointed. You might be.
Yeah, you could. Who knows?
You got to check it out.
Toy Rats. Toy Rats. YouTube.
Bye.
To see what you're going to find. And we've had some amazing stuff out of skips over the years. Still to this day, my dad works in scrap recycling and house clearances, so he's always getting stuff. Yeah. Like if my microwave breaks, it's no problem. My dad will have a new one in 2-3 days. Like I've never had to buy an appliance for years and things because of that. So that's just like your regular household stuff. But through doing what he does my whole life, I've always been around tons of toys. And I was born in 88. So, I mean, I'm nearly 40 now. I'm 38 in January. But so my like generation of toys is like what you're into. It's the Ninja Turtles and things. But because I was raised on around toy fairs and market stalls and car boots, I know you don't really get them in America, but like a car boot in England is a place where everybody goes on a Sunday morning, sets up a table and sells things, like just the household stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know what you don't have anything like it in America.
Meets.
A what?
Swap meets.
I thought you said a twat meet.
No.
That's a very different kind of meet, brother.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Swap meet, everyone like, they like book out this giant parking lot and they have tables, they throw their stuff out and you sell it.
Yeah. That's okay. So a swap meet would be like an American equivalent. I always assumed there were a lot more swapping going on at a swap meet. But,
Yeah.
So, I was raised around all those things. So even though I was born in 88 and the toys I would have had was towards the end of the 80s, because I grew up around all these markets and stuff, so many of the toys I had growing up were from years before I were born. My dad was always of the mind frame of like, you don't go to Toys R Us and spend like £20 on one toy. You take that money to the car boot and you come home with a car full of toys. So a lot of people have this big nostalgic attachment to Toys R Us and things. And I do have an attachment to it. I did enjoy going to Toys R Us as a kid. But that's not where like 80, 90% of my toys would have come from. They was all from car boots or from like the AdMag, which was a bit like Facebook Marketplace, but a paper back in the day where people would list stuff for sale and things. So yeah, tons of my toys growing up were secondhand, way older than me. And also, I mean, it wasn't until years later when I got into hardcore toy collecting, when I really tried to research stuff, that there were so many toys I had as a kid that I didn't even know what they were called because I never got them in the packaging. I remember getting like a little steel metal, like die-cast Shogun Warrior from a car boot as a kid. I thought it was so awesome. I had no idea what it were. No idea what it were. I didn't have a clue. Do you know, like with the arms that fire off?
And
I'm just like, where's this come from? Who made this? I remember thinking this, bro, I'm like 5-6 years old, and I remember looking at toys thinking like, what factory was this made in? Where did it come from? Who made this thing? Like, I was always so enamored, so interested in the origin of things, even as a kid that young, which is why years later when I become like a big toy collector myself, like I always went so hard on all like the nerdy knowledge of the where it was made, the brand that made it, the year, and then again just something that like when I got into toy production years later, it makes me want to try new things and try new mechanisms and new articulation and new ways of doing stuff.
Yeah,
I'm just a nerd, bro. I'm a toy nerd from day.
I mean, that's what I think it's crazy because there's like a technical side, right, of toy making. There's side of
and
all
I'm not
that.
Even a technical guy. I'm terrible at technical stuff, but it still intrigues me. And I still try to do it.
But there is a very nerdy side of, like, we had this nerdy conversation about like Ninja Turtle bootlegs, right? That's my what I love. That's what I do. And so there's that kind of thing of like, what country is this? What year is this from? Where'd you find this? Those kind of things. But then there is a real technical side. Like, you do this for a living. And it all is based on this love that started with your dad going to these like giant shows where these all these people just pull up and just sell whatever.
Yeah, yeah. But the maddest thing is when I used to go to the toy fairs, like back in the day, it was Star Wars, it was $6 Million Man, it was Action Man, Palitoy, or you would have had them as G.I. Joe in America, but you know, like the 60s, 70s, 80s stuff, gripping hands, flock hair.
Yeah.
Eagle eyes and all that kind of thing. So when I used to go to the toy fair, there might be two or three stalls that had like turtles and things. Like it was all like trains and Star Wars Kenner and stuff. It was like, if I went to a toy fair with my dad, there might be 300 stalls, but there were probably only four or five that like I was actually interested in. I didn't need to ever look at another Action Man. My dad had got all the Action Man in the world and the Steve Austins and stuff. That was all like normal to me. My dad had a table full of Action Man and $6 Million Man and Mego and Tonto and Lone Ranger all the time. So I was like more intrigued in like some of the late 80s, early 90s stuff. But you got to think, like, at that time, I'm like so young that it wasn't really collectible. Right. I remember my dad and his friends laughing when I was a kid, laughing at like, oh, it'd be all right if 90s toys were worth money. We'd be rolling in it, like, and they're laughing because they just weren't worth money then. So like, even stuff like Biker Mice and late Thundercats and all sorts of stuff, like, they just weren't worth anything. I remember my dad going to a discount store and picking up, do you know Driller from Thundercats? Super rare figure now on the card. And he had like 15 of them and they were just in a discount store. And he said to me like, oh, do you want one? And I was like, nah, it's a crap figure. I'm not bothered. It don't even have legs. Like at the time, I didn't want it. So, and then now I've got a lot of my collection, a good chunk of it that my dad picked up like that. Loads of Ghostbusters and things that he picked up on clearance when they were just worth nothing. They were like £2. Or at a toy fair, somebody might have like a bunch of carded He-Man or whatever. And because they were the late 80s ones, they were selling cheap. I know for a fact, anything that I've got from my dad, other than some of the Action Men, he won't have paid much for, because he wouldn't have wanted to pay much for any late 80s, early 90s toys. He will have literally just bought them because he thought they're worth putting away for a few years. Maybe Theo will want them when he's older, which obviously I did. So I've got some tidy stuff that my dad just got from these toy shows back in the day. And it's so funny now that you're talking about the bootlegs, because when I was at the car boots, we would see a stall full of He-Man, and if it had bootlegs on it, we'd walk past it. We're like, oh, we don't want them crappy fake ones. You want the proper He-Man. My dad would go, you don't want them Nesbitt ones. You don't want them tacky ones. They're cheap. they fall to bits. You want to go and buy the proper He-Man. And I also remember, this is how far we're going back, like 50p was the highest you would pay for a Motu figure back when you was a kid. If it was more than 50p, you were a rip-off and you'd go to the next stall.
Yeah.
But this stuff was just everywhere. Whereas like now, if you saw a car boot stall and they were 50 pence each, it'd be a riot. Like.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's funny. Like, I go so far back to a point where late 80s and 90s figures just weren't worth anything and nobody wanted them, so you could pick up as many as you wanted.
Yeah, it is crazy. I mean, what's interesting about 80s and 90s figures is that some, like Street Sharks, they're insane to pick up now. It's like if you find a package one, it's like $250, $300. But back then it was like $5, $6, $10 bucks.
Oh yeah, even 10 years ago, I went to Japan. I think it was about 10 years ago. I went to Japan for the first time, to Tokyo. And to thin out some collection and get some money together, I sold all my Biker Mice, my Street Sharks, Extreme Dinosaurs and things. Because at the time, not only was it like, if I want them back, I can pick them up on eBay.
Yeah.
Pretty cheap. And I just sold them all. And then now, I mean, they're still not worth like as much as some stuff is worth, but triple the price they were when I was selling them. Yeah, it's mad. Bootlegs and things and what they're worth now and the 90s stuff. I'm waiting for the Ben 10 and the Skylanders to skyrocket.
What's interesting about like the 90s toys is you have these brands that inevitably skyrocketed. But then you have brands like one of my favorite figures I can remember constantly is Iceman from a Toy Biz X-Men, like 94-ish.
We had all them as well. He got all them discounted, all the X-Men back in there. Yeah.
And now, like back then, it was like $5, $6 for the action figure. You can still pick it up on card for like $10. For some reason, some of them didn't get
There's a weird spike whenever X-Men 97 come out for like a little bit. They went up again. I was at the toy fair and everybody was pulling out all the old toy biz, Marvel, the X-Men and things, because 97 had just dropped and they were going like hotcakes. And of course, if you've got like a Deadpool or a Wolverine or like a staple character, they're still going to be worth a bit more. But you're right, there is still a certain faction of figures that still don't slap. But I still think they're awesome. So I haven't been on the toy hunting thing for probably like close to 2 years now, because I've just been concentrating on my toy collecting, my toy making, and I've got more toys than anybody needs. I've got a whole room full. I've got loads in storage. But whenever I did go toy hunting, I would go for like the reboot figures. I went through a phase of like wanting to pick up a full set of reboot, because you could get them for like a tenner. So but why not? Go for the reboot. I think they're dope. I'll get them. Pirates of Dark Water, I picked up all them when they were pretty cheap. Little Vampire, I think that's Little Vampire. I picked all them up, except for like one or two that I still haven't got. But yeah, they were just like £10. So I was like going out for the 90s figures that weren't so sought after. And also bear in mind, like any big 90s line that was released in Britain, at least, I either have already or I've had and sold, because I had no attachment to them anymore. I mean, there's even stuff like Mighty Max shot up for a bit, but you can still pick them up. Like, you still can get them. If you go on if you went on eBay every week and says, okay, I'm going to spend about £40 a week on a Mighty Max, you're going to get one or two every week. They're going to be some bigger hitter ones. At least the last time I checked, do you know what I mean? £25, £30, £40 tops for like a complete set. You do still get them. So there is still some that's nice. You can still get Z-Bots pretty cheap. I like Z-Bots. Z-Knights you can still get pretty cheap. There's lots of like little offshoot. Like I kind of see it as like, you might be into horror films. You might be into like, oh, I love Freddy and Jason and Scream and stuff. But then you also might be into like Spookies and The Blob and Waxwork. And like, they're still certified 80s movies with great effects, but they're a little bit more off the beaten track. And that's what I'm a bit like when it comes to the toy collecting. I've seen, this is not me sounding big-headed or anything like that, because I was raised by a toy collector, I've seen pretty much everything. And I've also seen it when it was so cheap that nowadays, even if there's something that I quite like, I wouldn't pay the higher price, because it's not really that special to me, because I've seen it a million times. And I would rather go and pick up some reboot or some Space Precinct or something that no one else cares about. I'm pretty sure that, give it another 10 years, they will. Skeleton Warriors, I picked up all them when they were super cheap. Now they've gone up. Not quite as much. Same with Toxic Crusaders. I picked all them up when they were pretty cheap. Nah, they're crazy. So, I like to think, if I see something and I think it's kind of cool now, probably in the next 10 years, other people will, and that'll start skyrocketing in price. I'm just lucky. Yeah. I picked up so much of my collection years before, like the Toys That Made Us come out and Lockdown and Stranger Things, and that got everybody into nostalgia again. I'm lucky that I got most of mine before that. And the stuff that I go out hunting for now is like the rare, weird Japanese kaiju.
Yeah. I mean, that's the, the Toys That Made Us, them coming out, and like it skyrocketed some of the toys. And
friends of mine as well who work on that show and produce it and edit it and things.
Yeah.
I've had them on my show. I've had them on Slime House before.
Heck yeah. And I think the hard part is like, there are so many toys that over time I eventually will get. But I think I've settled with things like bootlegs, because it's like that, or like kaiju, Sifubi, soft vine. Like, those things matter a lot to me.
Of course, man.
Over production toys. I just have no interest in production toys at this point.
Nice to have a focus. And the thing is, you could be like, I had every single Power Rangers Zord
boxed.
Everyone for like the first four seasons or whatever. Again, picked them up real cheap. But I sold most of them. Well, I sold all the box ones again before like a Japan trip I went to about 7 years ago. But then recently I was playing Fortnite and it's got all the Power Rangers on it and Megazord. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I kind of won't mind a Dragonzord again, to be fair.
Yeah.
So it does come circular. It only takes one thing, like X-Men 97, to be on, where you think, oh, I won't mind picking up some of them, actually. They are kind of cool. But also, I'm in a very good position where if I really want something, I can make a very dope one that's a one-off. I just have to sculpt it and print it and paint it and everything myself. So it just means there's a whole bit of time that goes into it. But I can also make a video about it on my channel, so
yeah,
I do also have that option as well. Yeah.
So your dad collects, it goes to you, and he's getting you all the toys and stuff. At some point in every kid's life, there's a moment where you kind of walk away from toys because you're trying to either figure out who you are, you're growing up, all those things. Some of us get lucky and don't ever walk away. Where are we at? As we get older a little bit, where are you at? Do you forget toys and come back? What are we doing?
Nah, No. I've been into them from day. I changed my tastes of what toys I was into. It got to a point where I was like, I don't know. So let's say like 12, 13, I'm looking at like Ninja Turtles, and to me they're like kiddie toys, and I'm more into picking up the McFarlane Movie Maniacs.
Yeah.
And I was into all that kind of stuff. So I went like heavy into the McFarlane figures, and a lot of my old toys either got like put back on the car boot, or I kept some that like I would never want to get rid of, some of my specific Z-Bots and things, but they weren't on display. It was just in boxes. So yeah, heavily into the Movie Maniac stuff. And this is before like NECA released 50 versions of Jason and Freddy. This is when there was just like one Movie Maniacs Jason, one Movie Maniacs Freddy. So I was, because obviously when you get into being a teenager and you start getting into horror movies and things, I was into all that. Action movies, always big into Rambo and Terminator and stuff. So as soon as they started releasing like detailed figures of characters from movies, I was like, oh yeah, this is where it's at. So my collecting has just got into different directions. And then after that, like after the McFarlane thing, after they started releasing too many, I started like going on eBay, and I was buying Kamen Rider and Ultraman figures and things, and buying Gachapon figures. And yeah, and then it just became full circle to when I was like 19, and I got back into picking up the 90s toys and things. And because my dad was always in that world, it wasn't hard for me to be like, oh, I'll just dad, keep a lookout for these types of figures for me. I feel like collecting some Transformers, keep a lookout. Within a couple of weeks, he would have got loads and loads.
Yeah.
Just because of the world that he was moving in. Now, my dad's not a toy collector anymore. He's still got an amazing collection. But yeah, he's not like actively out hunting for them at toy fairs and all that kind of thing. He thinks they're cool. I made him a figure for Christmas last year. He likes the toys that I make and stuff. He would rather now give his collection for me to display and put on my channel. He's a big supporter of my channel and stuff. So I've done like a few episodes on Action Man, some of the rarer ones and things, and the space ones and the cool monsters and stuff. And I've done like a few episodes like showcasing them and things. I love that stuff. I'm currently in the background right now 3D printing like stands that the Action Man go on, because I've got a new display that I'm putting together. I'm on a right tangent. I know I'm going all over.
No, this is perfect. This is what we're here for.
I can't even remember what your question was. I told you I'll talk a lot.
Yeah.
Especially if it's toys. Especially if it's toys or movies and that. It doesn't take much to get me going.
Yeah. I mean, like you get 19, you're asking for more toys and stuff, but then you start to pivot, right? Like we've talked about how you did kind of like the rap battle thing, how you worked on movies. Did you go to university?
Nah, I won't get in there.
Okay. No. So
my grades weren't getting me in university, bro. No. I went to college. So after school.
Yeah.
Obviously, like I said, I did illustration for many years, and I still draw all the time, and that's how I'm decent at sculpting and things, because I studied anatomy and comics. But yeah, basically through school, all I ever cared about was drawing. I was banned from PE for being dangerous and messing about. I was always in trouble, always in fight. So my mom used to pick me up every day, and she just dreaded picking me up because it was just always a fight, always getting done for doing graffiti. I was a problem child, and it wasn't. Do you know, like some people see like a kid who's naughty and they go, I blame the parents. My parents weren't to blame. I was just a guy who just struggled to behave in any other lesson other than art class. So yeah, art is just all I ever cared about. All I ever wanted to do is draw and make, and I wanted to be a comic illustrator for years. I even dropped a video like a couple of weeks back where I found out all my old artwork, all my old sketches and stuff, right from being like 5 years old up to leaving college and the whole progression. And I tell all these stories about how much I loved art and things. So yeah, after school, my natural progression was to go and do art at college. Now, I wanted to be a special effects artist. That's what I really wanted to do. Like once my comic book artist was like my fallback. If I can't, as a kid, you're like, I want to be a wrestler or I want to be an astronaut. Like I wanted to basically be a special effects artist like Tom Savini or Gennaro De Rossi, who did all the Italian, Sergio Stivaletti and all these like Italian special effects guys that I admired. I wanted to be like a Tom Savini, a Rob Bottin. That's what I wanted to be. So I was always sculpting and things, but basically like in England at the time, you couldn't just go to college and do like a prosthetics course or a special effects makeup course. You either had to do like TV beauty makeup that maybe did a little bit of like a cut on a face and things, or excuse me, you had to spend a lot of money. So there was, can't remember what the school was, but it was like down south. It would have meant I had to move to London, and it was like $7,000 or something, £7,000 to go on this special effects school. And I got the booklet and everything. And I just didn't like the look of it. And I didn't want my mum and dad having to spend like $7,000 to send me to special effects school. So I basically, I know I'm going on mad tangents, but from school, between going to college and doing art at college, I also like went looking for people making independent film. So I just hit up a load of different companies, even if they weren't doing like horror or genre stuff, hit them up. And I managed to work with a few independent film companies doing their effects. And through that, I not only learned that like I enjoyed working on film sets and being part of that world, but I also learned that I liked doing the filmmaking way more than the special effects stuff. So I would like get my home camera, my own video camera. I want to do an episode all about this at some point. I want to find all my old home videos and my home movies and stuff and make like an episode talking about everything, showing all the best bits. But I got my home video camera and I would be filming like little zombie films with my friends and special effects, little short films of people getting chopped up and stuff. And I found myself like stressing and obsessing so much about the storyline and the editing and everything more than the effects. So it ended up being like, maybe I want to be a filmmaker. Maybe I like doing the effects and stuff, but maybe I'm a storyteller. It's almost like if you was like a drummer in a band, but then you think, do you know what? I like drumming, but I want to be singing. I want to be writing songs. I want to be writing melodies. I don't just want to be doing drumming, which does happen in bands and stuff. So that was me. And I'm talking like back when you had to film and then edit it on a VHS player, like pressing stop and record and stop and record on the camera quick. Oh man, I was buzzing when I found out you could like put it onto a computer and chop it up like I can now. But yeah, I really wanted to be a special effects artist. And it wasn't until like years and years and years later, making my movie Unit 11, I made a whole feature film. You can buy it. You can buy it in America. You can buy it all over. You can buy it online. It's not like a very well-made film now looking back, because I was young when I made it. But I'll talk about it later, but a very impressive film for like made off nothing. But it wasn't until I'd done all that I was like, do you know what? Like relying on all these people constantly, like to get together, your location, the weather's got to be nice. You're on a time limit because lighting, you're losing lighting and I'm doing the effects. I'm acting in the things. I did a lot of acting. I'm directing it. It was like, I really enjoy making films, but I don't enjoy the stress of having to like wrangle 50 people together for scenes. Well, not 50. I never had that many in my film, but like 20 people together and a location. And so much that so many outside factors that that you can't rely on, that you just have to hope all come together on the day in order to make a film. And when you're doing it with no budget and stuff, basically that's another reason why now I just enjoy making my own stuff on YouTube. I have still got another movie unfinished that I'm working on. I did some work on it the other day. That's like a slow thing in the background, but it's just so much more stressful having to rely on all these outside factors to make something great. Where at least if I'm here in my studio, I know I can make it and I can edit it. And I've only got myself to rely on, and up the 3D printer like prints my stuff okay and stuff. So I wanted to answer the question all the way back. We go back. I wanted to do special effects and comic art. I went to college, met the best friends I could have ever asked for. Because in school, I was always like, I was a street guy, but I was into nerdy things. So I would hang out with the street guys, but they weren't into the nerdy stuff. They wouldn't understand. Like if they were, like I remember being at a house party. And everyone's there and they're smoking and they're drinking and there's girls there and everything. And I'm just sat in the corner drawing on my black book. And they're like, oh, Theo, come on, get up, man. Stop being boring. I'm like, I'm vibing. I'm having a good time. Like, I don't need to drink and smoke and that. I can just listen to the hip hop in the house and draw. And that's me chilling. But they didn't really get that. They were like, no, you're supposed to be up chirping girls and that. It's a party.
Yeah.
So I did. I got on with them people to a certain level. And then the nerdy guys, like the really nerdy guys into Warhammer and writing like fantasy novels and things. Again, I got on with them to an extent because they was into some of the nerdy stuff, but not so much that I would want to hang out at their house and things. So I was always like a bit of I took me a while to find my people. And then when I went to college, I met a lot of guys that were like me, that were into drawing and they're into Transformers and comics, but they were also like street guys and they were into hip hop and things. Like I remember like walking into college the first day and I went to a college that was nowhere near my house. It was the other side of the city. So I went there and it was like in the kind of part of the city that was like very multicultural and stuff. So up until college, I'd only had like a couple of friends that weren't white. And they were mostly white people. And then when I went to my college...
We interrupt this broadcast of Toys on Tap to bring you this.
Meanwhile, in a galaxy of bootleg treasures...
DOV2, we have engine failure. We must crash land on DKE Toy Planet. Oh my, we're doomed.
Wait. Salvation! Hooray! We're saved, DLV2! Limited edition custom artist-made action figures and DKE toys!
Check out www.dketoys.com for a full catalog.
Hooray for custom action figures!
DKE!
I was like one of the only white guys. So I got to mix up with loads of people of different ethnicities and backgrounds and stuff. Asian, black guys, Chinese guys and stuff. And I loved it. And I really felt like I found my people. I just walked in one day and I saw a bunch of dudes that just looked kind of hood, like sat on a table with like snapbacks on and stuff and hoodies, and they were drawing graffiti and that. And I was like, yeah, they're my people. I'm going to make friends with them. And I made friends with them, and they're still my friends to this day. They're like my brothers, like family. I never wanted to leave college. I said that in that recent video, but I really didn't. Like, do you know when you just find your place and there's no pressure to like make money and that, because you get a little bit of money from college, only like £30 a week, but it was enough for me to buy an Xbox game and go to the arcade and stuff. I never wanted to leave college. And like I said, to this day, they're still my closest friends. They're not always in my videos and things. I've got a lot of friends that aren't bothered about being on camera and stuff. But yeah, I really met my people at college. And yeah, just regardless of what I've ever been doing, it's always the creativity that's drawn me in. It's always the creativity that I've obsessed about. Like now, if I'm working on a sculpt, I'm painting something, I'm working like 15 hours, 18 hours nonstop just to get it finished. And I will like that when I were drawing my comics. I will like it when I'm making my movies. I just have this like, and again, I'm not trying to sound big-headed. It's just, it's in my blood. It's in my soul. Like, just to have this tenacity to do lots and always test myself and make it better. You'll never see me create something unless I'm on like a really short time limit and I want to test a new resin or something. You'll never see me create anything that's, I've seen him do this 50 times before. He's just like going through the motions. I never want to go through the motions. I'm always like, I've got such desire to create something new or try something new or try a new type of articulation or test myself a little bit. I'm going to make this figure have more printed parts than ever, and I'm going to make them fit together more smoother than ever. And I want to use a resin that's more flexible so it feels more like a toy, and I want to try new paint and blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
That's insane. That's so much going on. But you found your place with these people that, like, I think that you're describing so much of the toy scene at large, right? Like,
yeah, for real.
The nerdy scene of, like, Warhammer that is crazy, painting miniatures and all that stuff, and doing Lord of the Rings fan fiction and all that stuff.
Yeah. And that's awesome. I love it. I love to see all these nerds go and playing LARPing in a field. I love it. Like, I love that they found their people. Even if they're not like, even if I probably would feel a bit stupid doing it, I love that they love it and they're just unapologetically themselves. I love that. I'll never be the kind of person that's like when you're a kid and there's like, oh, you can't sit with us. I would never be the kind of person that would think, oh, I don't want to be seen with that guy or whatever. I don't care who you are, what your background is. I don't care if you're gay or straight. I don't care if you're nerdy or cool. I'm not bothered. I love people to just be authentically themselves. And I can jam and talk and hang out with and chill with anyone. Like,
yeah, it is crazy to see like the coolness of that in the toy community. And then people bring all this nerdiness and all this weird stuff in, and you see cool things like, there's a graffiti toy magazine that comes out from the original Cash brand on Instagram. And then there's all these people that did Warhammer 40K. They're painting miniatures. Now you see how good they are when they paint resin figures.
I wouldn't be able to paint like I do now if I'd not messed around with Warhammer as a kid. Like, for sure. I've made a lot of like Warhammer-inspired toys and things. Like, I love it all. It's all cool.
Absolutely. So tell me, we go from there. Tell me how we get into, because it's got to be this group. How do we get into the rap battle scene?
Oh, it weren't that at all, really. I mean, I just used to watch rap battles on YouTube. And then when I was making my movie, there was a battle rapper that I used to watch called Respect BA, who was like my favorite. But he used to talk about how we did martial arts and things. So I just got chatting to him on MySpace back in the day. And I just said, like, oh, I think I was just bigging him up about his music. And he goes, oh, I've just seen that you make films. If you ever want me to come and do a cameo, I'll do some spin kicks in your movie. I'll have a little scene. So I'm like, yeah. Maybe me is just like, oh, 100%, I want to, let's work together. Like, come this weekend kind of thing. So came to Sheffield, which is like a 4-hour train ride from where I am. Came, hung out in my film, and then just got on really well. So then I started making a documentary about him and following him around. And while he was at the rap battles, then I ended up being the cameraman for some of the rap battles. And I just ended up doing battle rap. But it's not even something I get into and talk about. It's like a whole different part of my life. Like, I don't even want to be known as a battle rapper. It's just something that I did for a long time. But talk about being around a bunch of different people from different ethnic backgrounds from all over the country and then all over the world. Like, we'd have events where there's like 1,000 people in the crowd, and we've got rappers from LA and Atlanta and America, New York, Australia, Malaysia, every kind of color, every kind of background, every time of sex, every type of sexual orientation, and we're all there battle rapping, saying the worst things to each other, and then after all having a beer and a pizza, hugging, and we're all brothers, and we had the best time ever. Like, yeah, talk about like growing up around like a mad mix of people from all over, that would all break each other's balls on and off camera constantly. Yeah, it made us like, do you know, like now when I see things like cancel culture and I see people like getting offended at stuff, I'm like, dude, like I wish you'd have grown up like I did, because none of this stuff, you wouldn't care about any of it. Like,
yeah,
you really wouldn't. I so wish that everybody grew up in a multicultural circle of people of all different types, because you just, when you get older, you're just like, yeah, like I'm so thankful that that's the upbringing that I had, and still to this day, I'm around people of all different types of people. So
yeah,
it made me basically, yeah. So from the battle rap thing, I didn't do battle rap because I wanted to be a rapper. I did it because I was sick of like relying on people to turn up for filming and things. So my movie Unit 11, there was like a 5-year gap in the middle of it where I just wasn't filming anymore because I was just so sick of being let down. One of the people that was in it was going to join the army, so he's like, unless we finish it in a year, I'm not going to be able to be in this film. My Jeez. Ex-girlfriend was in it at the time, and then we split up. I had this big location that was organized and all locked in, and then they let me down on the day of filming, and I had to like re-fix everything. And I got to a point where I was like, I just hate all this. Like I was saying earlier, I hated relying on everything to come together to get it finished. I thought, at least if I do a battle rap, as long as my opponent turns up, all this hard work I'm putting in will at least amount to something. So that's why I did it. It wasn't because I wanted to be a rapper. I could just rap. I was around battle rappers. I was filming them all. I knew them all. I was in that world. So I ended up doing it, and I did like 10 battles. I only ever lost one. And I battled some of the biggest in the world and things, but then I just realized this isn't what I want to do. I just kind of felt, bro, like I had this like beast inside of me. It sounds corny AF, but I
love that.
Felt like I had this beast in me, this like mad raging energy to do something. And I'd done like 3 years of battle rap, and I had not lost it. No matter how aggressive or crazy I got in the battle, no matter how much I like focused on the writing for it and stuff, because this is all written battle rap by this point in the world of battle rap. It's not freestyle. I was doing all this and I still felt like I've got this beast. I'm like, do I need to? Because I were doing kickboxing at the time, and my instructor were like, oh, I think you should have some fights. He's like, I think you're good enough to fight. And I'm thinking, should I do that? Should I fight? Should I go into the K1 ring and fight? Like, and I never did. And I basically thought, do you know what? I got a job covering somebody. Do you know, like I said, I worked in schools and colleges.
Yeah.
A job covering my friend who was a college teacher, one day a week, sometimes 2 days a week, while he was like doing a diploma or something for like a bigger role at the job. He had to go to university 2 days a week. I covered his college class and taught him filmmaking. And through just being with those kids and seeing their love for it, and they're asking me questions and filming with them, like I literally owed so much of it to those kids, and I'm still friends with some of them now, and they've got kids and things because obviously they're way older now. But through doing that, I thought maybe I want to make another film. And then it was only like a weekend, I thought I probably should just finish the film I started. I've got loads of friends. I'm friends with everyone still. So yeah, got everybody back together. We finished our film, Unit 11. It took like 10 years all in all to do. Something I was super proud of, big premiere with everyone there and things. And even though looking back now, there's lots about it that I'm like, that white balance is terrible, that frame rate is so off, that camera's way too shaky. In terms of like an accomplishment and an achievement, it's like a massive chapter of my life that not only is it like, I watch the film and I'm like, this is a film that I made. This is like 10 years of my life on camera. There's friends in it that are no longer with us. They passed away now, and where they're acting in scenes together. So there's like a whole chapter of that film that I see when I watch it of like, okay, that's me and all my friends growing up and becoming adults on camera. But also all the stories behind the scenes and all the craziness that happened and all the problems we ran into. I got arrested so many times making this movie, like the police arresting me for like having like prop weapons and being in locations that we broke into and shouldn't be there. Like just doing it pure ghetto style the whole way through. It's something I'm super proud of. It's just one of those that when I look back at it, it's not just a film to me. It's like somebody might look at home videos. I look at that like, yeah, no, this is my friend. This is the location. Like, Slime House, the name of the channel, Slime House used to be an underground cinema that me and my friends built. I used to work at a vintage center, and I'd take my toys in and have a big stall selling them, like, do you know, like an emporium where you leave them?
Empire Blister.
Empire Blisters. specializing in action figure blisters. 2.75 inch or 1/18 scale. 19 different styles. Two sizes of clamshell figure cases. Four different bulk pack options. Quantities of 100 sample packs available.
Empire Blisters. Now sponsor Toys on Tap.
That means a 10% off coupon on checkout. Use code Toys on Tap 10. That's TOYSOMTAP 10.
Empire Blisters.
Antique shop or something.
Yeah, they take a note of what they want to the desk, and then they take the money, and then you come and collect your money like once a month, and the Emporium takes a percentage. So I worked at one of them, and they had a basement not doing anything with a load of chairs in. So I basically converted it into an underground cinema. So every month, me and my friends would show two movies back to back. We'd show like The Warriors and They Live, or The Blob and Rambo. Two random movies, but like a couple of crazy bangers, and we'd serve chili. We also allowed people to have a smoke in there, because in England, you're not allowed to smoke inside because it was private. I let them smoke, and I'm like, you smoke what you want in there. I don't smoke, but if you sit in the corner near the extractor fan, you smoke what you want. So we'd have a lot of people that enjoyed coming down, having a smoke, watching a film, eating some chili. And we called it Slime House Cinema. And I only called it Slime House because before Slime House, I used to do a grime event called Grime House, where like UK grime, which is probably more known as like trap now in England. In America. But before that, it was grime, like Skepta and everyone and Getz and P Money and things, big into that music. And I used to run an event in Sheffield, the biggest grime event, and have loads of MCs on and stuff. And I called it Grime House. So just because it was a cool name. So when I set up my cinema, I called it Slime House so that people still kind of knew it was attached to what I used to do. And there's a weird crossover between people that rap and also like movies. So I call it Slime House. We used to show a lot of Melt movies and slimy movies with The Blob and Ghostbusters and stuff. And then I got the opportunity to make like a TV show for what you would have as public access.
Mm-hmm.
Public access, right? So I made a TV show where I'd review a bit of toys, I'd interview some rappers or some filmmakers, anything cool, artistic, retro and edgy, I called it at the time. And they're the first four or five episodes on my YouTube channel now, Slime House, and I called it Slime House TV. And I presented it in the cinema with all my people that came to watch the movies all sat in the chairs, like a live show doing an interview and then some like cutaway sections. And and after that video, we actually decorated the whole cinema to look way better. But so it looks pretty grimy in those scenes, but it really sets the tone of like an underground basement. Do you know, like you would go to like a free party rave where it's a rave in an abandoned building and there's just so many people in there and a sound system that police don't lock it off. They just let you do what you're doing until the next morning. It was basically that vibe, but a cinema. So Slime House TV started as Slime House, the TV show that I filmed in the Slime House cinema. So the first four or five episodes on my YouTube, they're very different to what I did after. It was me presenting in front of a whole audience. And then what happened is I didn't really know how I wanted to focus the YouTube channel. I hope your audience don't find this boring. I know they're here.
No, they're going to love it. They're going to love all of this.
I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I loved filmmaking. I loved rap. I loved graffiti. I loved toys. I loved art. And I just basically, it was like a collective kind of situation when I first did Slime House. If I knew a filmmaker, I'd interview him. If I knew an artist, I'd interview him. I interviewed some massive names. I'm also the guest liaison manager of HorrorCon UK, which is a gigantic horror festival here in England. So all the guests that would come over, like Doug Bradley and Kane Hodder, Linnea Quigley, all these like famous names, I would be in charge of getting them from A to B. And I would also grab an interview with them. So I also have a lot of like interviews with horror legends on my YouTube channel. But basically, I got to a point where I wouldn't even really want to do an interview with someone on the channel if they wasn't like a big name now, because I felt like it were going to lose the momentum. This is also before people even really knew how to have a YouTube channel, and you knew about like how to market a thumbnail and a title and keeping everything on in like a certain genre and a certain kind of branding and that. I just did whatever I wanted to do. I put it on my YouTube channel. The first ever video on it is a feature-length graffiti documentary that I made. So that shows like the diversity of Slime House. But basically, when lockdown hit, I'd been out to Japan toy hunting and putting those episodes, and they did well on my channel, probably better than anything else other than the graffiti documentary. When lockdown hit, I used to film basketball events. That was like my main hustle. I was an illustrator, and I used to film big basketball events as a cameraman and an editor. When lockdown happened, we couldn't film basketball events anymore. People weren't paying me to draw illustrations anymore, really. Obviously, the whole world was in turmoil. So I thought, well, I want to film something. I live alone. I want to do something with my time. I'll just review my toy collection. I'll do like cool little documentaries. And I did one on Z-Bots, one on like Monster in My Pocket minifigures, one on Mighty Max. I just kept them coming. And they started to build up a little bit of momentum. And I thought, do you know what? Maybe I'll just stick to the toy thing. Maybe I'll stick to primarily the toy thing. I'll have little offshoots here and there, but I'll push the toy thing. Then that gate, and then when lockdown finished, that gave me the impetus to be going out to do more toy hunting. And I filmed lots of toy shows and toy fairs and things. And I've become a real well-known guy in the toy world. I know everybody in England that buys or sells toys, like all the main people. I know all of them. I go to the NEC. I know pretty much every single stall. NEC is the big like Midlands toy event that we have in England. I would pretty much know every other person in every stall. So I was going to them and filming pickup videos. And yeah, I mean, that then just got to a point where I felt like I'd seen every toy, I'd filmed every toy, I'd filmed every event in England. And because I'd always been creative, I'd always been into making my own characters and sketching fan art and stuff. I just wanted to get into making my own toys. And I'd done little bits here and there, hand sculpting, but I thought I'm going to learn 3D sculpting. I'm going to learn 3D printing. And for the past like 2.5, maybe 3 years now, that's been the primary focus of my channel. Done little bits here and there, a bit of HorrorCon filming, a bit of traveling around. I just did like a video where I went to Switzerland, to Zurich, and filmed the giant Safubi collection that someone had bought in. And I've got some more videos dropping with that guy. The odd Gundam video, the odd review video, but primarily I wanted to be seen as a toy maker. So that's what I've done. And I've only been doing it for a couple of years, but yeah, out of everything I've done, that this so far is my most favorite.
It's amazing to watch. I remember hearing, I love the guys that do ToyCon UK. I don't know what it is about them. Love them.
They're awesome. Good friends of mine. I'm the official guy that videos that event every year and stuff. Yeah,
that's what I'm talking about. Like, that is so sick. And I think that someone had said, maybe it was a year or two ago, someone was like, oh, you need to look up Slime House. And I was like, I don't know what that is. Like,
I suppose on paper as well, Slime House, it could be anything.
Right. And so was like, I don't know who that is. And they were like, oh, that's crazy, because like they are in this scene. Like, they do toys everywhere and all this stuff. And I went through and watched a bunch of videos and I was like hooked, especially because I knew that you were connected to different people are a part of the scene. And so watching those things and to just on a whim in 2020, like, make this a hit. Tell me about the first video. Like, I'm always interested. Like, this is cool and it's a great career. Tell me about that first one. When you didn't have the setup, you didn't have all like the cool background, you had all the toy, like, tell me about that video.
Suppose it's hard because the first video, as I said, it was a graffiti documentary. I made a feature-length graffiti documentary. Still one of the highest viewed videos on my channel, constantly gets hits. Graffiti is, it goes crazy on YouTube. And I know that because I recently did another graffiti video where I painted a big subway cart and made a Jet Set Radio figure to go and stuff. And it did really well.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm going to definitely do some more graffiti stuff. Not only because obviously I love graffiti. The first video that's like, I'm trying to think the first video that was like toy related, because when I did Slime House TV, I had a whole section where we cut away and I reviewed all the Jurassic Park Kenner toys, and then I talked all about Alien and Predator toys and about how kids' toys were made from adult films. Not adult films, not like Deep Throat, but like Terminator and that. Do you know what I mean? Not a manual. And RoboCop and Predator and all that kind of thing. So even the first Slime House videos after that graffiti one had toys. But the one where I probably... It's crazy, actually, because probably one of my biggest influences to do what I did was you know Chance Priest, didn't it? Because you had him on the channel recently.
Oh, I love Chance.
He's a good friend of mine. Yeah, we go back years, me and Chance. I love him to bits. And he was doing those videos where he was like, he'd pull out a box and he would talk about some toys. And I used to love watching him. And I thought, okay, I haven't got bins like him where I can pull out the mad stuff he's got, but I've got lots of full sets of toys that I could just like talk a bit about them on camera. It's a bit of filler content. I think probably one of the first ones I did where it was just me sat in my chair talking about a toy was that I reviewed the Sun Gold horror figures. You know, when there's like a Sharp Hand Joe Freddy figure and stuff. Yeah. I reviewed those. I believe the Sun Gold. My mind's gone blank. But I reviewed those toys and then I used to get sponsored by a company at the time called Nima Studios, who were the only people in England that got all the... Now they make their own toys, they do a completely different thing. But at the time, they used to be the only people in England that could get all the exclusive Super 7 figures, not like the 3¾ kind of style, but they'd make all like obscure characters. And this is after Reaction, because there was a time when they were doing like Nightmare on Elm Street and Rocket Man and just like more like mainstream stuff. They started to do like Planet of the Apes and Lucha Wrestlers and more like more stuff that was a bit more punk and that, I suppose, lots of Misfits figures and things. So they used to send me a haul of them every month and I'd review them. But again, very unscripted. I'd just pick them out. And I mean, I watch them videos back now and they cringe and I'll just say, a lot and that. But yeah, that's just how it started. And then it wasn't until lockdown where I was like, okay, I'm going to shoot this more like a movie. I want like nice panning shots on my gimbal, make sure the lighting's good. And I look at them back now. I look at them back now and I cringe and the lighting's terrible and the strobing. And I'm ridiculously hyped for some reason. I'm like, in today's video, we are going to talk about the Mighty Max. And I don't know why. That's just what felt right at the time to talk more hype in my videos and swear a lot more and stuff. So, yeah, do you know what? Sometimes you just have to do a lot of things that when you look back, you don't like. And it's like, I think if you look back at something, even if you did it a year ago and you're like, I don't like that, it's cringy to watch. That's a good thing. That means that you're improving.
Yeah. My first videos and my first interviews.
So if you look back at an interview from, I don't know, whenever, your first interview, and you're like, oh, I'm terrible. That's a good thing. That means that you're improving. That means that you're getting better. Hopefully, I'll look back at what I'm doing now in 5 years and be like, oh, it's cringe. I hate what I say. I hate how I come across. That's a good thing. It means that you're improving.
Yeah.
If you can't look back at something you did 10 years ago and cringe, then you know what I mean?
That's bad. Yeah.
You're just so perfect from day one that you came right out the gate on point 100%.
Yeah.
But no, I think it's important to look back and cringe at what you used to do. Or look back at something like some of my battle raps. I might have said something and I think, well, I would never say that now. That's so out of order. But so that's a good thing. It means I've improved as a man and as a human and I've got better and I've learned and I'm a better human than I was. So yeah, I don't think there's nothing wrong with looking back and seeing something whack that you did ages ago or you were cringy or you was, I don't know, not as confident on camera. My Japan toy hunting videos, I did them before lockdown. I went to Japan with my girlfriend at the time. And we also, like, I was doing Slimehouse, but I didn't go out there with the intention of like, I am going to film content. Right. I just had my camera with me, filmed a few bits. And when I got home, cut it into episodes. When I go away now, I'm going away just to film. That's my only focus. But
yeah,
so I would have filmed them way better. And then when I'm back home, the talking head stuff that I do to cut into the footage of me being in Tokyo hunting, like that's cringe. And I'm just not confident on camera. And it just takes a while to find yourself when you're on camera all the time. You know what it's like when you first ever put yourself on camera and you're like, oh, I don't even sound like that. That don't sound like me.
Yeah.
But then eventually you get to a point where you've been on camera so much that your voice in your head and the voice on camera all just blends into one.
Yeah.
You ever remember when you first hear yourself on camera, like the first time, and you're like, that doesn't sound like me?
When you see
yourself from a weird angle and you're like, whoa, I didn't look like that. I'm disgusting. I hate how I look from that angle. And then you just get used to it and you're just me, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That one is crazy because I still, like, even now I'm like, do I look like that? What happened today? I went to a speech pathologist.
Really?
After my first interview with someone.
What is that? Like someone who teaches you to speak better?
Yeah, so it's like, I wasn't there for them to teach me to speak better. I was there trying to figure out, like, why do I sound like this and I don't sound like this? And
what, like, you had to go to, I don't understand. What, like, yeah, you need therapy to help you just no, like, I didn't, those things together?
Yeah, I didn't actually go to the therapy. I just met with one to figure out, like, why I sounded the way I sounded and what was happening.
It threw you off that much?
Yeah, it, like, no mentally way. Was weird for me. And she said, well, the reason why is because when you speak, you're hearing it through your skull and everything, so it's deeper and it's, like, different. But then when it's recorded and played back, you have no idea who that is. Because that's the first time you're hearing it outside. And it was such a weird thing for me. Like, I sat in that meeting and I was like, how do I fix that? And she was like, I don't know if you can
just
fix
time,
it.
Just time, right?
Yeah, just, like, don't be weird.
Yeah. You are being weird.
Yeah. And so, like, I did that. Yeah. That was crazy. But yeah, you're right about if you don't look back and cringe on it, did you improve, right? Like, my first interview, I tell people, don't start there. Like, don't, like, start maybe last week with Chance. Don't go all the way back because that's chaos for me.
Yeah.
And so, I think about that. So you make that first video and you're sold. You get to a point in which you're traveling all over to do toys. You're doing toy hunts. You're toy collecting. You're starting to dabble in sculpting and 3D resin printing and all these things. How does it take off? How does this become full-time Slimehouse?
I still don't feel like it's took off now. I haven't. There's no defining moment so
Never.
Far with it.
Yeah.
Like sometimes you speak to someone and you go, "When did your YouTube pop?" And they're like, "Do you know what? I did this episode, and I got 50,000 subs in a month."
Yeah.
And but I've never had that yet. Mine's been such a slow burn and a slow progress. And part of me is happy because I'm thinking, I'm glad that I didn't blow up when I was battle rapping or blow up when I did my first videos, because they're not even the thing I wanted to put out now.
Like, right.
The stuff I'm doing now is what I love, what I'm doing now. The toy making stuff, that's where I've really found myself. So if I did a video tomorrow and it popped off, I would think, yeah, this was the right time for it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I've had some videos I've dropped and they've done right way better than my other ones. Like,
yeah.
They've given me like, and I've got like a nice sub count of stuff from it, but I haven't done anything that's like really just set the world on fire. And I mean, what do I expect when, number one, there's barely any people making toys on YouTube. Like, tell me another five people that make toys on YouTube. That
I can do
toys.
Like one or two, yeah, maybe.
That's it. Yeah, like yeah. The Craftsman, he makes toys from time yep. to time. There's a couple of other people I watch. But like, there's not a scene for it. So if you got into, let's use Warhammer for an example. If you were like, okay, I'm going to start up a Warhammer painting channel. You type in Warhammer painting, there's a million channels. There's 20 guys that are like half a mil to a million subs. So you could be like, okay, they're the kind of people I need. That's the level I need to get to aspire to be. They're the people I could do with eventually networking with and collabing with. There's a patent there. There's not for toy making.
Mm-mm.
Toy collecting and hunting in itself is so niche. Like, it's even more niche than like retro game hunting and collecting. Toy collecting, just and then you're like, and what are you collecting? Oh, I specifically collect random knockoff turtles bootlegs. So not only are you saying I just collect Ninja Turtles, which puts you in a bracket, I'm
yeah.
collecting the knockoff versions of them. So you're just putting yourself further and further down this rabbit hole. So I make toys on YouTube, but I also don't make toys of popular things. I'm not like, okay, I'm gonna make like what's popular, like Five Nights at Freddy's or something.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm not making Five Nights at Freddy's figures. I'm not making what else is pop. Tell me something that's popular right now that you could think, okay, that's what it, Labubu. I'm
yeah,
not making
yeah,
a Labubu
yeah.
action figure, even if I'm doing it in my style. I'm making, like, my last video I made, the Day of the Triffids, that was a specific late 70s, early 80s.
Yeah.
BBC TV show. I'm making like figures of random obscure games because I want to make figures that haven't been made before. If I'm going to make like a fan art version of a toy, I want to do something that hasn't been made before. So I'm not making a Spider-Man. I'm not making I'm not even making a Ninja Turtle. I'm making like such obscure stuff. So I exist in a very niche little world, and I accept that, and that's fine. And I'd rather be buzzing in my own little lane. And even when I do toy review stuff, so like I've done a couple of toy reviews over the past few months. I've been reviewing my friend's Sifubi that they've made. So
yeah.
I'm reviewing like underground stuff. I just went and did a big toy review thing of someone's Sifubi collection, like I said, but it's all obscure art toys. And if you're into that world, it's awesome. But most people don't even know what a Sifubi is. They don't even know like what soft vinyl and art toys and designer toys even are.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. No. That is the hardest part about this whole scene. Is like being in it for 4 years and like collecting and making and all this stuff. It's re-explaining it every time you talk to someone.
Yeah, yeah. Every Sifubi episode I'll do, I'll be like, so just a quick recap if you're new here. Sifubi is a specific type of soft vinyl that's made primarily in Japan in a very specific way. And I have to go through like a whole speech of just saying what it is before we even then get to the thing I'm reviewing. But the flip side of that is like when I was in battle rap, there was a time when gimmick battles started to become really popular. And there was one where like a young kid battled an older guy, and the older guy always wore a suit and the young kid looked like a little kid. So they pitched it as teacher versus student rap battle, and it got millions of hits and it did really, really well. But so for a couple of years, they were doing these gimmick battles. They might do Batman versus Robin and have two people dressed up and battling as Batman and Robin,
yeah.
Breaking balls as that. And they were fun to watch, and they'd get a lot of casual viewers in. But then as soon as it becomes back to like the real battle rap, they weren't bothered, and they only were there for the gimmick stuff. So you'd have a channel with thousands and thousands and thousands of subscribers, but only a percentage of them actually was there because they liked hip-hop and liked rap. I wouldn't want to start doing popular stuff and then gaining a whole big subscriber count of people that want to see me make something like a baby Grogu, and then they don't watch it when I'm doing the actual thing I want to do that I'm passionate about. There's no point.
Right.
It's like having a one-hit wonder, right? Like you could have a one-hit wonder, but then they don't listen to the other songs that you make. So it would be nice to wake up and you've got 50,000 more subscribers, but I'd want them to be people that are genuinely there because they like what I do. And because I do a variety of things, mainly toy making, but I do other stuff. I'm so lucky that the core subscribers that I've got, whenever I ask them, I did a poll recently saying, why are you here? What do you want to see from me? Like, so much of a percentage of that was like, we just like to see you do you. We're just invested in the way that you present videos, the way that you film them, your critique on them and stuff. So I'm lucky that I don't have the, like, I'm nearly on 30K on my YouTube. It's not a small channel, but it's also not 300K. But most of my subscribers, the ones that come back every single week, even if it's a video that doesn't do that well, I know that like them 4,000 people that watch everything I do are there, but regardless of what I put on there, because they know it's going to be presented well in a Slimehouse package. And I can't remember what your initial question was, so you'll have to remind me.
I don't know. I get too excited about this stuff. What's crazy, you're describing something like that I think that I wish every artist knew, right?
Chance knows. Look at Chance. I listened to his episode with you before, and he said, "Chance, I don't care if I never make a penny from this stuff, because I like to do it, and the people that love his stuff love it because he's made it."
Chance knows that at any moment, if he sends me a message and says, "Hey, I have all these Ninja Turtle bootlegs ready to go," he'll make a penny. I'll make sure he makes a penny. Like, yeah. I will just give him everything. I think I wish that every artist knew this, that like, so this year our channel's grown, our like Instagram has gotten bigger exponentially because of certain toys that we've produced. So it's people that may not like love the toy scene, but they love what we've made. And in doing so, they don't interact as much. Like, there's some posts that still get like 30 likes, but like, what I wish more artists knew is what you said. Like, even with 30,000 subscribers, those 4,000 are so dedicated to who you are. Yeah. And with every artist, I've told people before, like, everyone is someone's Banksy. There is someone watching you that is like, this is my guy. This is everything about everything I love in toys. This is everything. And I wish that more artists knew that as they were producing stuff.
And I also think that it's, when I'm into, let's say I find someone on YouTube and I really like what they do. I'm not like just into that person because they make something. If they do a podcast or an interview, I want to listen to them. I want to hear about them. I want to find out what makes them tick. What are their inspirations?
Yeah.
I don't just like surface level and get into something. Same with like movies. I wouldn't just watch a movie and go, oh, that was a cool film. I'm like, who directed it? What else did they make? Have they got any interviews? What's their inspirations? I want to see the making of. I want to hear them talk about what gave them the idea. I'm always like as much into the person and their story and what makes them tick as much as the stuff that they make. And I feel like obviously not everybody who follows me is like that. And there is some that are just there because they like the odd thing that I do. But right. Then I do have a core audience of people as well who are like into me being able to do an episode talking about me old drawings and my inspirations and that.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't set the world on fire at all. It's one of the worst videos on my channel. But the people that watched it, that's who it's for.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Like, when I make funny things, like we just filmed Mark Nagata. He's one of my favorite people, and I can't wait to put his videos out. That video, even if it got one view, that video was so important for me to make because I respect him as an artist.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
If one person sees it, that one person's going to love it.
I feel like if you're making something and it's not necessarily what you want to make, but you know it'll do well, there's nothing wrong with that. And some people, they can do that and it's fine, but it's not something I could do.
Yeah.
If I'm making something and I think, like, I made some, like, old, like, 90s-style action figures of some Warhammer Space Marines, and I knew doing it that this is probably going to, like, reach a new audience and people are going to like them. But I wouldn't have been able to make them if I were like, but personally, I hate this design. And, like, it's not something
I could.
That's not something I could do. So sometimes it's just the planets align, and fortunately, the thing you're making also happens to be something that is going to hit a bigger audience. But that don't mean that that's every time. Like I said, when I do Day of the Triffids, like, no one cares about that. Like, well, they do, but like a very small percent compared to something big like 40K. Yeah.
Take me into making, because you've had some videos that I've watched lately that I really want to talk to you about as far as like tariffs and stuff, and then take me into making your first Safubi.
Safubi particularly, or first toy that I made.
Let's start with first toy.
Well, the toy bleeds into the Safubi, so.
Yeah. So let's start first toy. I mean, just know we're headed towards tariff, because I do want to talk about that video with you.
Yeah, yeah, for real.
But because I'm about to get hammered on a shipment real soon, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, we'll get to that then.
But yeah, take me to the first toys. You start doing sculpting and 3D resin printing and all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's good. It all ties into the tariff thing at the end of the story. So.
Perfect.
Yeah. Sorry, you were saying I interrupted.
Yeah, take me through that first toy. I mean, it's not – everyone has claimed – I have a really good friend, More Horrific. He has sculpted for me. We've worked on different projects.
Right, I'll check him out.
He is one of the best sculptors I've seen and worked – he works with Mondo.
Sounds like somebody I should already know. I might even have him on Instagram and
probably
not recognize the name.
Yeah. Insane. And he has told me, like, you need to learn how to sculpt. It's really intuitive. Mm.
Yeah.
When I look at it, it's not intuitive. Like, my brain doesn't function that way, but you put in the effort to start sculpting.
It's intuitive if you can draw a bit, and then it's right. I mean, you don't even really need to be able to draw. If I said to you, sculpt me a caveman's club, just do like a rock club. Yeah, do you know what I mean? You can do it. Everyone can sculpt a bit. But the hardest thing with the 3D sculpting is learning how to like mesh things, because every time you stretch it out, it stretches the polygon. So then you have to like keep remeshing it, which then, so if you've got like, let's say you've got four squares and then you pull them like that, and then all of a sudden you've got four really stretched triangles, press a button that will turn each one of those four triangles into 100 triangles. So the detail retains, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like super pixelated. So, but then also, because I work primarily on an iPad, it crashes the iPad a lot if you have too many. So I'm always fighting that balance, which is why I'm learning ZBrush. I want to get into ZBrush and stuff, which is then just the next step anyway. But yeah, it's such a funny story. I was playing Doom. I was playing old school Doom, the first Doom. And I was playing it, and I was shooting at the Kaka demons, you know, the floating balls that are in the game, that are basically a ripoff of a D&D character that they just took the artwork for and made it symmetrical and turned it into a ball. So it's always been derivative of something else. But I was playing it and I thought, it would be cool to get a cool toy of these, like the old one. And then I looked at Amazon and I saw that they did a coin bank of a Packer Demon, like pretty simple Sufubi style. I thought, oh, that's awesome. I want to get that. But it was about $80 or something. I thought, I'm not spending $80. I'd pay for it for a Sufubi, not for like a factory-made production toy. And then I got paid for a job, and I kept thinking about it. I thought, I'm just going to buy that thing. And I went on and it had sold out. This is how I remember it. I did a video covering all this stuff. But basically, I thought, okay, this is how my brain works. This is how I won't be beat. Because I couldn't get it, I thought, all right, well, I wonder if I could 3D sculpt and print my own one. How hard would that be? I'm thinking, I'd made like mad balls before that were like sculpted out of Sculpey. I did a one that was inspired by the Book of the Dead and one that was inspired by They Live, called Formaldehyde Face. And we'd hand cast them with my friend. Like, he taught me how to cast it and mold it and stuff. And I put them out as like resin, hand poured resin toys, hand sculpted. So I thought a ball isn't that hard. I'm not trying to put arms and legs and give it a weapon and everything. I just thought, sculpt a ball with some horns, I could probably do it. So I already had an iPad because I do all my drawing on that. I downloaded a sculpting app at the time, which was called, it wasn't Nomad, it was a different one, a different app that weren't very good. But I sculpted it on that, very simple, sculpted this head. And I thought, oh, yeah, it's pretty cool. I've got it there. Next minute, I'm like, all right, I guess I best look into how easy it is to get a 3D printer. And at time, I'm thinking 3D printers are like £700, £1,000. And then I looked and Elegoo did one for like £180. And I'm thinking, I could 3D print on that one. The old Mars, was it the Mars? The first one, the green lid. So I thought, I'll just buy that and a curing machine. So about £250 later, I'd got the printer and the curing machine. I also knew that down the line, if I got this to work, I would be able to effectively print my own toys, make my own stuff. Like I said, I'd done some hand sculpted things. So, and it was always something toy making, from watching like the Suck Lord on his podcast and everything, and these resin toy makers. It were always something I had a lot of interest in. And obviously I was a toy guy, and I was someone that, like I said, as a kid, was really interested in how things were made, toys especially. So I basically, got a 3D printer, learned how to put the thing I'd sculpted into the machine and print one off. And like the first time I saw that thing, I was like blown away. I couldn't believe that I was taken back. I couldn't believe something I sculpted looked that good printed in front of me. And the detail was so well round, so well preserved, even though it had shift lines and it weren't perfect. But anyway, that was it then. I started sculpting arms and legs for it, and I made this whole thing, and I gave him an axe, and I made my first toy, my first character. So it was based on the Doom Demon, but I'd changed it lots. I'd give him a body, and I called him Turgo. My friend came up with a name, Turgo. Yeah. I don't even know where from. We just were throwing around like mad names for like a barbarian space alien. Turgo. So I made that, and then I showed it to my friend Rainbow Yawn, who was a dope resin casting toy maker. So I know, like, would you be interested in making these for me? I don't know how to cast things like that. I've done a little bit, but you're the master. I don't trust anyone in the UK who could cast this better. And he went, oh, yeah, I'd love to do it. So we did it. I made it. I put a video out, and I made sure that we had them all made so that when the video dropped, I said, in 2 days' time, these go live. So they look really nice in red and black marble with a bright neon glowing green glow-in-the-dark sword and a little minifigure. Put them online, and within about 7 seconds, it sold out. Like, they sold out so quick. So then a few months later, I did another run of them in green, and I called them Swamp Assault Turgo. Again, 5 minutes, bro, all sold out. Now, we only did like 10 at a time, but they sold out straight away. And out of everything that I'd done in my life, filmmaking, making T-shirts, doing illustration, I'd never sold anything I made so quick. So I thought, okay, this is kind of feels like the planets aligning. Like, I've been into toys my whole life, a painter, an illustrator. I've been painting Warhammer and that as a kid, and painting toys, and then I'm 3D sculpting, and then I'm getting my friend to cast them. Basically, maybe all this is just leading to me making toys, and that's how I'll make like my money. So yeah, made them. They all sold out. Then I got in touch with my boy Vega in Italy, who I'd met through ToyCon and things, and I said, I kind of just like put it out there, like, because he was showing me Safube that he'd made, and then I showed him my Turgo, and I said, imagine this is a Safube, and he's like, bro, would you be up for it? And I'm like, yeah, but I ain't got the money to get a Safube made. It costs thousands. And he's like, don't worry, I know people who'll get it cheaper. I'll fund it, and we'll go 50-50 when they're made. So we're like, lock it in then, let's do it. So within a few months, I'm in Italy painting them. We did 50. Again, did a video and said they're going live in 2 days. Sold out. Within 24 hours, all sold out, all 50.
Unreal.
We kept a couple back. I kept two. We kept a couple back for ToyCon. They all sold at ToyCon. And then he kept two that he wanted to do like custom paint jobs on, which we sold recently. So yeah, they all sold. So I don't know. We sold like 45 in less than 24 hours at like £200 a pop. Do you know what I mean? And I'm like, dude, like this is where you can make something fucking dope that you want to make and people want to invest in it. And they're not there like, I mean, I'm from the toy fair world where someone picks up a carded figure that's £30 and they're like, no, would you do 25? The card's a bit beat and that. And they don't want to, they might spend a lot of money on the odd thing. Like, let's say, for example, like one of those Ninja Turtles you've got behind you, one of the rare ones. What's the price, like going rate for like one on there, one of the rare ones?
Oh, like $70. Yeah.
$70. That's like the top end of a bootleg.
Of these.
Yeah, yeah. So let's say $70.
Yeah.
Now, to some people, they might think like, oh, £70. It's 70. Let's say £70 for me. £70, oh, that's a lot of money to spend on a toy. In Safubi, that's cheap.
Oh, that yeah.
That's cheap, bro. Like,
yeah.
So I can't remember the exact price they were, but they were about £210 or something we did them at. And yeah, they all sold out. So we're like, well, yeah, this is where the money is in Safubi. Not that I'm in there for the money, but it's just nice to know that if I do make something and I do spend months making it, I can sell it. Mm-hmm. I'd spent many years of my life spending time drawing something to put out as a print and struggle to sell them, or T-shirts, and like you're struggling to make up the numbers and stuff. But with Safubi and the art toy, people just seemed to be invested in when I make something. Now, this is not speaking for the future. The next thing I might put out might be a flop. But so far,
right,
the things I've made, I've put out, have resonated with people enough for them to want them to sell out. Now, so yeah, that's that. So I've only made the one Safubi so far. I've worked on other people's things and made this and sculpted their Safubi and things, but that's my own creation that I made with Vega as a collaboration. And then obviously I've made episodes where I'm developing like resin Safubi and all that kind of thing, but that's a different conversation. But interesting you were talking about the tariffs, because recently we got those three that we held back, the three Turgo blanks that were held back, and Vega did like really cool paint jobs on them, did them in three different colors. And I put on my Discord, because my Discord people, because when I don't sell things very often and I do low runs, so they don't get like the chance to buy them over other people, really, like by joining my Discord. It's not like a paywall to get my Patreon and my Discord. It's not a Patreon to get exclusive access to anything that I sell. Mm. But I at least told them on Friday these are going to go for sale at 7 p.m. if you're wanting to get involved. There is only three of them, though. And they're like, and Vega wanted to sell them for like $350 or something like that. So they're a higher price than what they were before, but they're all one-offs. But if you are wanting a Turgo, there is going to be three available this Friday. So straight away, I mean, all my Discord were like, yeah, that's sold. I'm having one. And they're saying, oh, well, if you want it, I'll let you have it, but I'd like this one. And they're like, okay, you take the white one. And this is before they've even sold, but they're just people saying like, okay, if it comes down to it, you get dibs on the white one, whatever.
Right.
So they were sold. But then that was literally like the day before, the day after that the US tariffs had come in. So if I was, which as you'll know, and as your viewers will know, has upped the price on what you guys pay on anything that's imported into the country. So primarily these people were all American that wanted to buy them. So if I'm sending a $350 Safubi, well, I'm not sending it, Vegas sending it from Italy to America. And he has to market at something that's like worth more than £20. Nobody was wanting to buy it worried because they was worried about what kind of charge they could be put on top of there. They might get like a $200, $300 charge on top of the figure that they bought. So yeah, that we only sold one, and the other two, I think he just put them back and he's going to put them on a toy show instead. Mm-hmm. Because he's going to decon and stuff. Maybe he'll take him to decon.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was like that's the only time when I'd put something out toy-wise that I hadn't sold straight away, and it was due to the tariffs because people were just worried. Like, I don't want to buy it, get excited, and then it comes and it tells me I've got like a $500 charge. Now, we've always had import charges. I recently got sent something, a big rhinoceros Safubi that's been made by an American artist. He sent it me over for a video. Now, he didn't charge me for it.
Is it Groman?
No, it's not Groman. It's Wretched Studios.
Okay.
A big rhinoceros. It's dope. I know what you mean, though, not that Groman one. It's in like a video I did recently, a big Safubi thing. It's about this big. It's massive. But it's like, I don't know, like a $250 Safubi. So he didn't charge me. He sent it me as a gift. He just said, yeah, just make sure you get some nice shots of it in the video, which I do for lots of people. Lots of people will send me a toy and I'll just make sure I get some nice shots. They can use them for promo. I'll put it in a video and I get a cool new toy to film and to put on my shelf. It's a nice deal. But he marked the price of what it cost. And then when it come to England, I got like a $75 charge on top of it, a $75 pound. Now, a £75 charge. Now, obviously, I didn't mind. He sent me like a $250 Safubi. Like, even if I had bought it, that would be like a steal. So I didn't mind. And it was unfortunate that that's what I got charged. Sometimes you don't get charged anything. It depends if it's UPS, if it's DHL, whatever. But I sucked. I just paid it. So we do have custom charges here, but the custom charge that you would have got vice versa would have been way more, because you could get charged. I'm seeing like you could get charged $200 on a $20 parcel. If I sent you a shoebox with some sweets in and some candy and some toys as a friend, just a shoebox, all gift worth no more than £20, you could still get charged $200 for it.
Well, I mean, there are some weird things. I will say, there's a lot of fear mongering that happens stateside where people just go nuts. The way that I've done shipping to other countries is when we've sold things, I mark it for what the cost was to pull it, not for what I'm selling it. So I'm marking the material, like the actual material cost, and then I'll sell those. Right now we're getting hit mainly from China, which is the dummy that's in charge is really causing issues here. And so they're about to put higher tariffs. I don't know what we're at, 30-40%, whatever. I'm about to get hit, which is fine. I knew what I signed up for when we did this. The bigger issue is that most people don't pay tariffs. Even on, we had this other thing that was like, if it was under $800, we didn't pay anything.
Right.
That has been since gone. But I will say that we don't pay tariffs on other stuff either now. Like, people that say that they get tariffs on everything.
Do you mean you don't pay it on other stuff? Things that's getting posted to you?
Yeah. So, like, I just got something shipped from Australia that was like a small toy. The guy that does all my toy photography for shots and stuff is over there. It costs, like, shipping is already a pain. And then when he sent
from
it back,
Australia,
I didn't get charged for it.
That's cool.
Is it
like a roll of the dice?
It is very much a roll of the dice.
Yeah.
And when you do get hit, it is a standard percentage that you get hit with. So people that say, like, there's people that are making claims that just aren't true here. They're like, I'm going to get charged $150. Maybe, right? Like, if that's because the U.S. knows that, like, you're a liar when you mark on the thing. Like, so many of us put, gift or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, we're lying. And so they don't know how much to charge. So if you're honest with what's in it and how much it's actually worth, you'll get charged that much. This is not me agreeing with tariffs. Tariffs are eating me alive, or they're going to. But yeah, like every time the guy would talk or open his mouth, my tariff bill was fluctuating between like 4,000 and 12,000 over and over again. And so, like we'll see what happens, but I think there are very clear, like, if you do this, this happens. And sometimes you get lucky.
Yeah. That's what it seems like. I know somebody who recently got a parcel from England and they had to pay like maybe like $20 on it or something, and I don't mind that. That's whatever. Like, if I had to pay, it's when it starts getting into the ridiculous amounts. And obviously I'm not in America, so I don't have a first-hand experience on how much it is exactly. But when I read into it and when I was looking into it, it did seem like it's so uncertain whether you would get charged $20 or $200 on something as small as £20 that it wasn't even worth, like, and especially when we're sending something over at like $300, $300+, it wasn't worth them investing in it yet. Like, paying for it.
Yeah.
So I have, in terms of my resin toys, I have actually spoke to someone over there. Well, a couple of people have offered actually about they would like do my resin casting for me. Like, they would print it, they would cast it. So the American ones were just made in America, but it was still my sculpt. They were just made and painted in America, so that could work. Do you know, when it comes to like the small resin stuff, because I've got another character, this Crushroom mushroom man that I made, that I'd love to make. And do you know, just do, I don't know, a certain amount in America and a certain amount in England, and then the ones in England can go all over the world, and the American ones are made in America. Maybe your Americans would even like that more, like made in America.
I will tell you that there is not a bone in my body that is patriotic like that. I can't even. There are workarounds, right? Like, I'm so close to Mexico. If it keeps going, I've talked about it here, where I'm going to go open a PO box just over the border so people can ship in and I can just drive it in. It's much.
You know, when you're driving to Mexico, does like the filter of life become like yellow? Do you know, like when you watch Breaking Bad?
Yeah.
You know, shot in Mexico, and it's like super sepia tone. And you're like, oh, they're in Mexico right now.
Yeah. It feels it does feel different, but it's like the issue is like now Toys on Tap is trying to think, like, as a whole, I'm trying to think, are we going to now be a warehouse? Like, people can ship all of their toys here if they want to ship and sell to the US like people. Are we just going to store everything
like a little distribution center,
just a holding just for indie artists? Like, right, we do have distribution centers here, but you have to use like have massive amounts. But maybe it's to the point where it's like, man, I will hold 10 of your Sufubi toys because it takes.
I know that, like, when it comes to ToyCon and stuff, I know that, like, a lot of people who shipped their stuff before, the guys who are running ToyCon, like, have some of the stuff shipped to them. So they always end up, like, I don't know if he just has them in his house or whatever. I don't know, but I know that he must have, like, a lot of stuff, like, sent to him that's held there until people can pick it up and then put it on their stall. But again, the good thing about doing, like, a Sufubi convention like that is you don't take, unless you chance and you take 500 figures,
most people will that take, is insane.
Know, like 30 soft will be, like, real head would come, maybe he brings 40 pieces and then that's it. Yeah. So it's not too bad.
So what's, I mean, with all of this and the tariff stuff and the toy making, and we know you have this mushroom character coming soon. What's next for Slimehouse?
You make it sound so fucking lame. You've got this,
little
mushroom man coming out.
No. that's my bad.
I'm only joking, bro. I'm joking.
Yeah. So it's like, what's next for Slimehouse? Because if the way that you talk, I hear it a lot in the voices of the toy community. They're just like nonstop, which hell yeah, be nonstop. That's my favorite thing. But that also means, like, you're always climbing and trying to find the next new thing.
Yeah. I am nonstop as well, bro. Like, sleep means nothing to me.
So what's the next thing?
Well, the so the difference between someone like me and then someone like Chance is Chance makes a ton of figures. Even if he does them as like the limited runs and things, he makes a ton of figures and he's constantly selling them. So in terms of the toys I make lots. I make several a year. In terms of the ones that I actually put out for sale, very few and far between, very sporadic. Literally when I feel like doing it, a lot of my toy making comes from me making a figure just to make a video about it on my YouTube. So I've got a shelf behind me. I don't know how much you can see. That's full of like basically production made figures that I, again, without trying to blow my own trumpet, I've purposely tried to make so that they look factory fresh finished, like they could go to production tomorrow, but I've just made them for myself. So like, I wanted a Toe Jam and Earl, for example. There's not a good Toe Jam and Earl toy out there, and I thought, and I want to make them look like, and this is the same for all my figures, I want to make them look like they came off a production line in 93, in 89, that kind of time. And so it looks almost like Playmates made it. And I want to make it in that style, and I'm going to paint it so it's beautifully painted, so neat. And I only said beautifully painted and so neat because I stress myself going over and cutting back and filing down anything I don't like and starting again until they're perfect or as perfect as I can get them. And I'll make a video documenting that process. And by the end of it, I'll have a cool figure. So it's like, I wanted to make this. I've wanted this figure for many years. I've now got one. This is how I got there. And it shows the whole process. Like I said, 3D sculpting. We're printing it. We're painting it. And so I make lots of figures throughout the year where I'm like, okay, I really want a figure of the Day of the Triffids. I've always wanted one. I'm going to make one. And I'm going to show you all my research, why I love this stuff, all these other things that are going to influence this toy. I'm going to start doing a paint job and then maybe have a little bit of a cutaway to some of my old figures and be like, I'm really influenced by this particular paint job on this Beast Wars figure.
Yeah.
And show a little bit on it and things and why I like it and how I'm going to try and replicate that finish with my toy. And yeah, by the end of it, throughout the year, I have several toys that I've made. I always aim for like 10 a year, 10 figures. And then between those episodes, because one of those like could take me 3.5 weeks to make. So I might do a video where I make a toy. And then I'll do a video where I try something. Like recently I learned how to sew because I wanted to learn to sew. So I learned how to sew. And so many toys come with little outfits on them and things. So I stressed myself for 3 weeks and learned how to sew. So I didn't actually make a figure, but I learned a skill that I'll be able to implement into a figure later on. And then what I do is, so from my YouTube, from doing that, I then get hired by companies to sculpt their toys. People hit me up and be like, oh, I love your style. This is my budget. Can we make this work? And 9 times out of 10, I can work. So I do lots of private sculpting for people. I also do toys for some people that are just like, I don't want it for anyone other than myself for my collection. I recently did figures of the two characters from Rainbow Islands, which was like the original Bubble Bobble.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I've got the game. I never even played it, but when he hit me up like Rainbow Islands, I was like, I think I know what that is. But anyway, I researched it, studied it, and I made him two factory looking figures of Rainbow Island just because he wanted them because they've never been made. And he's like, yeah, this is my budget, this is what I'd like to spend. And I'm like, okay, this is what I can make you for that budget. And I do private commissions like that for people. And then also I do stuff like, recently I did a collaboration with Ben Morrow, who is an artist and a comic book illustrator and a concept artist, and he's worked on like Halo and Elysium and all these big projects. He's like a really good sci-fi style. He wrote like a big thick graphic novel, the second one's coming out soon. And they hired me to do a video creating a retro style action figure of their main character, Huxley. So yeah, I made it in lots of different parts and painted it. And I put an LED in its eye and made it so it had a switch and everything. But I didn't just make it so that like, okay, 3D prints nice and it looks good on a shelf. I made it so that if he wanted to go to a factory tomorrow in China or somewhere and start putting them in production, he had everything there. It's all made, ready to go. They might want to adjust the articulation. They might be the odd bit where they're like, oh, in order for it to go in a mold, we need to separate this part and stuff. But he's 95% there, ready to go to production. So that's what I aim for with all my figures. There's so many that I could cut corners with and do them in a more simple way, just so it looks good for a video, but I'll never do that. I always want to have it so that I get to a point where by the end of the video, it's ready to go to a factory if I ever wanted to. Not that I can make a Toe Jam and Earl figure in a factory, but if I ever did want to and I got the rights to use it, to put them out or whatever, it's good to go.
Yeah. I mean, we could make it happen, right? Like, illegal or not.
I could have sold 100 of everything I put out. Whenever I release anything, like I did Toe Jam and Earl and I did Zool, I could have sold 100. I could have sold 500 of them. People who hit me up. When I did my Warhammer figures, the amount of people that wanted those STLs went crazy. I'm going to do a video talking about this, but I even got like Warhammer getting in touch with me like, yo, you better not be putting them out.
Yeah.
Like, Just let you know they're not going to be for sale because they looked that much like a factory produced figure.
Yeah.
If you just saw it, you'd think, I mean, this is because I made it look that way. So, yeah, there's not a figure on that shelf. Raziel from Soul Reaver. On that, there's not a figure on that shelf that I haven't had at least like 50 people hit me up like, oh, how much do you want? I'll buy one custom now. But I don't put out figures that I ain't got the rights to. It would have to be something like the Doom figure, like it was inspired by the Doom figure, but then I made it my own thing.
Yeah.
The only figures I put out are my own characters. The ones that I make on my channel are just for me and just to test myself and get better and better and advertise my brand. And yeah, so far it's been going good. So in terms of somebody who like makes figures and puts them out all the time, I'm not a production house. I produce my own toys and from it, I get onto the radars of people that hire me. I've just got hired to work on an amazing project. I can't talk about it yet, but an amazing Sofubi project for something that I've been a fan of for a long time. And they hit me up to be a part of that and I'm buzzing. So that's like something I'm working on. I'm currently doing two big custom commissions for two different companies that literally hit me up like, oh, we've got this game that's coming out. We just want some nice pieces that we can use to showcase the game. Just sculpted, made like a figure. Can you do that? Yeah. So I do. I take commissions all the time. I take commissions all the time, big and small. So yeah, I live in the toy world that way. I'm not at Hasbro designing their new toys. I'm not
putting
out figures every single week. I'm not even someone like in the indie Sofubi scene that's like putting out things regularly at every show. In every sense of the word, I kind of just weirdly exist in my own lane and I'm so comfortable in it and I'm happy for it to just organically grow.
Yeah.
Whether that's doing better commissions and getting hired by other companies, whether that's every now and again putting out my own figure run. Yeah, I'm loving just enjoying just going with the flow.
Heck yeah. Dude, I love hearing that. I will say that because of my love for Ninja Turtle bootlegs, one day I will reproduce a bootleg.
Yeah.
And just like full, because there's no company that produces those. And I'm just going to reproduce one and say, like, this is where we're headed. Just
no,
because.
You're judging, bro. You don't have to explain yourself to me. You do what you want.
Yeah.
You make that bootleg shit. You go to Mexico, get it made. I don't care.
Yeah.
I think it's awesome. I think it's. I own many bootlegs. It's
just,
everyone has like their own, just their own way of how they want to do their thing, their brand.
Yeah.
That's why. And I sculpted these figures from scratch, every one of them. So just because I based them on like a Toja Manel, it's completely made from scratch. I just don't want to put stuff out that's just not my IP. If I put some out, I just want it to, always want to know it's 100% mine.
Absolutely.
But I know loads of people that like do their own sculpts inspired by figures and things. Look at like Delicious Again Peter. He has scrolls full of old characters that are like based on rappers or characters from films and toys. I think it's awesome.
Yeah. Dude, it's been so good having you on, and it's
killing,
crazy.
Bro, yeah,
yeah.
Vibing, it's good.
And
it's nice. Sorry, not to interrupt you just while I remember it. It's so nice to have a podcast to talk on that's not only about toys anyway, which is fine. I'll talk on 100 toy podcasts, but one that specifically like caters towards the toy making as well, because it's such a small scene.
Yeah.
Such a small scene. Like I said, there's barely anybody doing it on YouTube. I never got onto YouTube and were like, okay, there's 10 other toy makers there. The people I've got to be collabing with, I've got to get on that level. There's no one. I'm literally, like I said, in my own lane. So it's really nice that this exists as a platform for me to be able to come on and shoot the shit.
Hey, and you're always welcome on. You ever want to just come on and do that? Yeah. The last part of every episode, we spend time just on plugging the artists and wherever you're going, where people can get in touch, all those things.
I've done this whole thing.
Yeah. But now you can make it all concise in this last bit of like, this is where you can find me. This is how you can get my stuff, all that. So please, please plug away.
So if you're still here, if you could put up with my weird accent and how fast I talk and all my tangents for the 2 hours or whatever we have been on, and you want some more, you want to see what I'm up to, you want to find out, like, you want to see firsthand all the stuff I've been talking about and how I get down, that's Slimehouse TV on YouTube. Slimehouse TV. I'm Theo Kane, and it's youtube.com/Slimehouse TV to check out my episodes. And if you're into toys, vintage toys, toy making, and videos that are also shot not in a YouTube style, I like to shoot my stuff very filmic, lots of lighting, lots of camera angles, lots of clever shots and things, again, just to make my life harder, but because I came from a filmmaking background, then I like to be able to be a filmmaker on my channel. I don't really call my stuff content. There's stuff like the tariffs video, that's content. When it's like me making that Day of the Triffids figure, that's not content. To me, that's a mini movie. So yeah, if that sounds like a bit of you, then head over to Slimehouse TV. I'm also on Instagram at Theo_Kane_Slimehouse. And if you want to join my Patreon and come over to the exclusive Discord, that's patreon.com/Slimehouse TV. And you're very welcome, not only to help me keep the lights on and to help support what I'm doing, but just to be part of a real small little scene that myself and a few other people are spearheading at the minute. And it's got a really cool community of people that all really support each other, hunt toys for each other, and of course talk about 3D printing and toy making in a nice little exclusive space.
Heck yeah, Theo, thank you so much.
No worries, brother. I appreciate you having me anytime. Hold tight, everything you're doing with the Toys on Tap podcast, and I look forward to tuning into whatever you have on next time.